This is Arts Alive for Saturday, April 8th. I'm Alan Chapman, filling in today for Brian Lauritsen. And today, no one writes movie music like John Williams. From Jaws to E.T. to Schindler's List, some of his most iconic themes have been written for the films of Steven Spielberg. Amazingly, the two have been collaborating for more than four decades.
Well, it is amazing. Of course, when one starts out working together, you never imagine that anything's going to last 5 years, or let alone 40, and we're still going. It seems as though it's all been happening within a year somehow. It must mean that we're having a good time.
A new collection of John Williams' music for Spielberg films is out now. More from the iconic composer in a moment. Plus, music, art, and beer. Not a bad combination. And you can find them all at the new Mars Festival. We'll talk to the festival's founders later in the show. And film critic Kenneth Turan is with us to talk about retirees who turn to robbery and something a little better. And on Ask the Dean, can orchestral music be so political that heads of state find it threatening? Dean Rob Cutietta of the USC Thornton School of Music has the answer. First, the arts news. From the Arts Desk today, a soprano's final opera performance and a mezzo-soprano becomes a museum. Superstar soprano Renee Fleming is closing the curtain on her opera career. She'll appear in the Metz der Rosen Cavalier, which opens this week. And after that production closes, Fleming will retire, at least from the opera stage. She'll still give concerts, record albums, and continue in her role as creative consultant for Lyric Opera of Chicago. Fleming told the New York Times she's following the example of Leontine Price, who retired from the opera stage at 58. Fleming is the same age. Her friends say she's been talking about retiring for a while. Novelist Ann Patchett is one of those friends. She told the Times that Fleming has compared herself to a carton of yogurt with an expiration date stamped on it, saying the day would come when she'd be thrown out. Instead, Fleming is exiting on her own terms. And the great mezzo-soprano and USC alum Marilyn Horn is getting her own museum. Next month, the University of Pittsburgh, in her hometown of Bradford, opens the 3,400-square-foot Marilyn Horn Museum and Exhibit Center, located on the ground floor of the school's Marilyn Horn Hall. On display when the museum opens, replicas of Horn's costumes, an exhibit called Starting Out in California that traces Horn's training and early career after her family moved to Long Beach, and Marilyn Talks, with anecdotes about her career recorded by the singer. Horn donated her personal archives to the university in 2013. She currently lives here in California and has directed the voice program at the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara for the last 20 years. That's the arts news for Saturday, April 8th. On this date in 1820, the famous armless statue known as Venus de Milo was discovered on the Aegean island of Milos. The marble sculpture was carved some 2,100 years ago. It's believed to depict the goddess of love and beauty, known as Aphrodite to the Greeks and Venus to the Romans. Oh yes, she did have arms at one time. In fact, fragments of an upper left arm and left hand holding an apple were found by the statue. Venus now lives in Paris, at the Louvre. And that's the arts news. This is Arts Alive. I'm Alan Chapman, sitting in for Brian Lauritsen. If you only have room for one collection of movie music on your shelf, this might be the one. John Williams and Steven Spielberg, The Ultimate Collection, three CDs of Williams' music for Spielberg films conducted by the composer himself, plus a DVD documentary about their decades of collaboration. John Williams stopped by the KUSC studios to talk about the album with KUSC's Jim Schweda, and here's part of their conversation.
When one starts out working together, you never imagine that anything's going to last 5 years, or let alone 40, and we're still going. It seems as though it's all been happening within a year somehow. It must mean that we're having a good time in some way.
That would seem to be it.
Yes. And there's a compatibility. It also speaks to something about Spielberg himself. He's a very, very loyal person. He's even loyal to technologies in a way. He was very reluctant to give up the 35mm film practice of making cuts with a butt splicer, which is just simply a knife,
yes.
A form of a knife. And he still has a composer who writes with a pencil, which is Wamem, yours truly. But he has switched to Pro Tools and the newer technologies. But alas, I have not, Jim. So I'm still pushing my pencil on paper and giving the parts of the orchestra in the time-honored way. But it's been great fun with him. One thing I'd like to mention is that all the way from Jaws to Schindler's List, there couldn't have been a greater variety of opportunities offered to me by Stephen and his projects. So it's been a surprise in the end, and a great treat and a great honor, certainly, to be doing these things.
Yeah. So to ask you the obvious question, what did you first think when you ran into this skinny guy with glasses and more enthusiasm than any two or three earthquakes put together?
True enough. I think he looked at about 17 years old to me, as I think I've told you before. And within the first 20 minutes of our conversation, first 10, I suppose, I realized that he knew much more about film music than I did. He'd been a collector of the old LPs of Tiomkin and Rocha and all the rest of them, and can whistle all the secondary themes of all these films, and had great love for music itself. His mother recently passed away, Leah, and when they lived in Philadelphia, Leah took Stephen to the Academy of Music to hear the orchestra play. He has grown up loving music. And a little anecdote about his mother, Leah, and the score of Jaws. When Stephen was taken to the Philharmonic Orchestra as a child, Jacob Krochmalnik happened to be the concertmaster of the orchestra in that period. And Krochmalnik left the orchestra and came to the West Coast. On Stephen's first recording session with large live orchestra, Jaws, his mother, Leah, came at Stephen's invitation. And our concertmaster on the film was Jacob Krochmalnik, who she hadn't seen since Philadelphia. And she was much more impressed by the fact that Krochmalnik was in our orchestra than Stephen had made a film and had a full orchestra at his own disposal.
It's fair to call Jaws the first of the real summer blockbusters. It kind of just changed summer and movies and people jumping out of bathtubs. Speaking of jumping people, I saw it in Maine, where I was living at the time. My dad came out to see me, and we saw it at a theater in Waterville, Maine. And I'm sitting next to my dad, who was a World War II D-Day survivor. He was at Normandy when Roy Scheider is chumming. First time you see the head pop up, my dad jumped 2 feet out of his seat, as did everybody in the theater. It had that effect on people.
A fantastic thing.
And nowadays you can't play da-dum and not see people jumping out of their bathtubs. I mean, it's just 1977 was a pivotal year. You went into competition for the first of, I think, what, 8 times when you're competing against yourself for an Oscar with Close Encounters of the Third Kind and the first Star Wars. Did you have any idea, as you're doing them, that these two pictures would have that kind of impact?
None whatever, Jim. Working on Star Wars, I think we all thought, well, it's a very different and very interesting piece, and kids will love it on Saturday afternoon, and then we'll move on to the next, until Joseph Campbell came along and explained to us the interconnectedness of George Lucas' myths. And how it seemed to be touching all humanity. It came, I have to say, as a complete surprise to me, and possibly even to some extent to George Lucas, although we're indebted to him for his imagination. When I finished the Star Wars, the film became a tremendous hit, Jim, you know, over first opening weekend. And I didn't have time to go to the theater or even think about it because Stephen had given me Close Encounters and I was scratching my head trying to think what to do with this film. I loved it, by the way, Close Encounters. I loved the film. So the year was compressed, 1977, by two really challenging projects on top of each other. And really all I could think of was doing the best I could with each one without any time to reflect on one or the other. I don't think ever has an idea when you're writing a score that it might be nominated. You may after a while begin to continue or think to hope for that. Certainly at that point in my life, that was the farthest thing from my mind. And getting the work done was the immediate challenge. What a surprise it was that when both of them became so successful, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg back to back in the same year, creating two such groundbreaking pieces, really.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not absolutely certain that the best score won, because this is the score that has my supreme lump in the throat moment. In the end credits, when Steven Spielberg's name appears, there's that descending string figure, and I just lose it every time, to this day. I mean, I just can't talk.
Oh, good. Well, that's good.
we occasionally play this during membership drives, and Rich Caporell and I one afternoon were talking about our favorite John Williams lump in the throat moments, and we're playing it over this, and I had to duck out, you know, and just let it play. Well, I've said this behind your back often enough, so I'll say it to your face. I think you write the best marches in Sousa. You really have a knack for that. You know, did you always kind of love marches?
I don't know. My music editor, Ken Von Berg, always used to accuse me. He'd say, John will write a march at the drop of a foot. Well, so many of these films seem to have required a march tune for one reason or another. And the other part of it, Jim, was that as a youngster, you know, I was in an Air Force band for 3 years. And most of the music that I scored, I won't say orchestrated or band-strated, perhaps somebody would say, at that time was for band, for brass and winds. And I did all manner of adaptations of pop tunes and other things, finding myself in the very fortunate position that I didn't have to do KP because they discovered that I could arrange for our concert band and our marching band. So I suppose maybe some of that stuck. And I also played the brass instruments as a youngster. I played trombone and a few attempts at trumpet, even tuba. And so I suppose the combination of those experiences and the requirements by the films I was assigned led to a few marches that you can drop your feet to.
Composer John Williams talking with KUSC's Jim Schweda about the new multi-CD and DVD set called John Williams and Steven Spielberg, The Ultimate Collection. You can hear more from their conversation on the KUSC Interviews podcast, and you'll find that at our website, kusc.org. Click on Radio and then Podcasts. You're listening to Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Alan Chapman, sitting in for the usual host, Brian Lauritsen. And still to come on today's show, a new downtown festival captures the glory days of the Arts District. But first, LA Times and Arts Alive film critic Kenneth Turan joins KUSC's Gail Eichenthal to talk about a criminal remake.
Zach Braff has a new film out this weekend called Going in Style, with a cast of very familiar faces, Morgan Freeman, Alan Arkin, Michael Caine, and Margaret, and more. Tell us about the film.
Well, if you have a long memory, you remember the 1979 version of this film. It's called Going in Style. The first version had George Burns, Art Carney, and Lee Strasberg. Clearly, it's an old person's movie. It's about three men well past retirement age who decide they're going to rob a bank. And it's about why they do it and what happens.
How does the film hold together?
Well, you know, the cast, you know, as you say, it's this great actors with Morgan Freeman, Alan Arkin. It's just hard, Michael Caine. It's hard to say a bad word about any of them. And they're very entertaining. It's very pleasant to watch them. But the whole thing just doesn't really hold together. It's kind of a lethargic film. It doesn't have much pace or energy. They really haven't done much with these really fine actors. As I say, the little bit they do makes it kind of entertaining, but you're frustrated. You want more. You want them to do something with it, and it's just the film just doesn't seem to have it in it to kind of pick up the pace and really totally involve us.
Well, is there something better opening this weekend for our dear listeners who need a good movie?
Yes, if you need a good movie, there is an excellent movie opening called Their Finest. It's kind of a play on the line of Winston Churchill, Their Finest Hour. It's a film set in Britain in the early days of World War II. It's got a great British cast, but the director is Scandinavian, Lona Scherfig. She did an Education, people I'm sure will remember. And
Carey Mulligan.
Yes, and Italian for Beginners before that. And this is a story. It stars Gemma Arterton. It's about a young woman who is thrown into the movie business in the early parts of World War II with helping to make propaganda films for the home front and what happens to her. It's a lot of different films in one. I mean, it's a romantic comedy in some ways. It's very, very funny. It's got just a stupendous performance by Bill Nighy, who's really one of the great treats to watch when he has roles like this one. But there's also, you know, this is the early days of World War II. People die. People in the film die. So there's a little darkness around the edges, but it's a really very entertaining mixture.
L.A. Times and Arts Alive film critic Kenneth Turan with KUSC's Gail Eichenthal talking about Their Finest, now showing at the Arclight Hollywood, and Going in Style, now out in wide release. You're listening to Arts Alive here on Classical KUSC. I'm Alan Chapman, sitting in for Brian Lauritsen. I hope you'll join us next week. We'll take you to the Huntington Library for an exhibit about author Octavia E. Butler, who created worlds unlike any other that somehow still felt close to home. That's next Saturday morning at 8 on Arts Alive. And you can listen to archived episodes of Arts Alive anytime with the Arts Alive podcast. Find that at KUSC.org. Coming up, we ask the dean. But first, the Arts District in downtown L.A. is full of creatives of all stripes. Next Friday, we'll host a brand new festival that throws a bunch of creative disciplines together. Festival Mars is a 10-day-long team-up of contemporary classical ensembles, including Ice and Kaleidoscope, along with visual artists, fashion designers, and filmmakers. It'll feature more than 35 local and international artists. The idea came from Wen Liu, a Chinese composer who recently moved to L.A. Liu and the festival's artistic director, Shana Nice Dambrot, spoke with contributing reporter Tim Grieving about this unique Martian journey.
I lived in Europe for many, many years, most 15 years or so. I was into many festivals as a composer, but it was always like exciting for musicians, but not really for artists or any other field. And then I got more information about L.A. that I knew that so many things have been happening, like the art scenes is just developing so big. And I thought, like, okay, I always had this dream, and I think L.A. needs such a platform to have, like, musicians, artists, everyone involved.
So where do you come into the picture, Shana?
It was just sort of like this perfect storm. Like, a lot of stars kind of just aligned, and I have friends who are in the classical music world in the USC Disney Hall kind of continuum. And so in the earliest talks about putting this together, my name came up. And I think partly because I had done 2 years of the LA Weekly's Artopia Festival, where I programmed video and performance and installation and visual art and different kinds of things like that. So this mutual friend of ours knew that about me. And it just sort of clicked when she said all that she just said to me about wanting to be in a festival that really included all of these things. I knew exactly what she was getting at. That sort of interdisciplinary thing is very much a zeitgeist in the art world that I come from already. I find increasingly people in the arts also want to collaborate with each other, with musicians, of course, with video artists, but with, like, choreographers and architects and chefs and fashion designers, and they all want to work together.
What's driving this desire amongst all these creatives to team up? And is it kind of unique to LA, to your knowledge?
Yes and no. I think it's no longer unique to LA, but I think that since, you know, the 50s and 60s, it's been kind of LA's thing to get more cross-disciplinary. I mean, there was always a thing with artists and scientists at JPL, for example. Architects and artists and early performance art and a lot of, you know, outdoor collective kind of activities. That's always been part of LA's personality. But I think that's been embraced now by just generations from everywhere in the world. And I think it just reflects the everything all the time, simultaneous nature of every level of human existence of the 21st century. And I also think that people seek out the company of other humans kind of in the face of increasing technology.
Was it difficult to round up collaborators or the kind of people you wanted to participate in the festival?
No, actually, because we got this idea and with our ensembles and groups, musicians, everyone got so excited. And so we brought like Ice Ensemble from New York and the Pamplemousse also from East Coast. And we had this local chamber orchestra, Kaleidoscope. I never had a problem to get people together.
As you talk about it and as I read the website, it can tend to be in these kind of lofty, somewhat vague descriptions of what this is.
Well, it is the first one.
Yeah, but yeah. Is it... Is it a struggle to try to like articulate what it is when it is all these things? Or is that part of the appeal, that it's kind of like mysterious and you can't really boil it down into a simple sentence?
It's all of those things. I mean, it's, I can talk about it for an hour, but it's impossible to tweet about it. for that exact reason. I've been shorthanding it by telling my artists that our aesthetic is analog science fiction, which makes people smile and is fun to say. And I think it's pretty unique and kind of gets to the point.
So as far as venue, at least some of it will be in the Angel City Brewery.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that chosen?
We had to contact the Art Share, and then they were very interested in collaborating with us. And then it turned out that Angel City is also a partnership or somehow with Art Share. And we were looking for like not just one venue. And we thought like it's a 10 days festival, so it has to occupy like the whole art district.
Yeah, the people at Angel City are great. Their relationship with Art Share has to do with having art throughout their spaces permanently and then extra during like festivals and things like that. So they are really all about being in the arts district. And so now it's like a beautiful beer hall with a stage at one end and a lot of, you know, it's a really nice place to play a show.
I mean, is it fair to say that this festival sort of embodies the arts district itself?
This is the kind of stuff that used to go on in the old arts district, except on fire in the middle of Traction Avenue. So they'd build art robots and set them on fire, and they would joust in the middle of the street, and Al's Bar and Bloom's General Store. These were insane places to be. And so if I were going to say that it embodies the arts district, I would just like to speak up for the old guard and say, this feels to me a lot more like that arts district. No offense to anyone.
So when you have at least one piece world premiering?
Oh, yeah. So, of course, I currently just finished the piece for ICE that are going to premiere at Mars.
And you're curating?
Yeah, I'm curating the visual and performance art and installation and video. One thing I really loved is I'm learning a lot about the music that really is at the core of this. What's exciting for me is I knew who Kaleidoscope and Pomplamoose were before. Oh. So I felt very fancy for knowing that.
And you didn't know ICE?
I didn't. I know. And then I realized that I was crazy for not knowing, and now I know. And I feel so much better. I'm nerding out now that I understand how impressive that is. I'm excited for my people to come along with me and learn about the music.
Actually, this is my mission, let's say, like my dream for this festival, that, you know, to have artists and the musicians to know each other and to work together in the future and to create networking for them. And I'm very glad to hear already someone said, oh, I learned a lot from music.
Definitely.
I have to say that I think Mars is the not the first, but definitely like a few festivals in the world that we program the pieces very equally. And you can also see our board people, that women and men, we just same. It's been always happening that on the newspaper you read like the men festivals in the world, that the board member just men. And I'm very proud that I got the best ladies on board.
It's definitely a women-owned business.
Right, yeah.
Which are all Martians.
Martians.
Oh, that's interesting.
Festival Mars, which stands for Music and Arts Resound, will take place April 14th through the 23rd in the Arts District in downtown LA. You can learn more about it and purchase individual tickets and passes at festivalmars.com. For Arts Alive, I'm Tim Greedy.
And now once again, Gail Eichenthal with a question about musical resistance for Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
First of all, Dean Rob, such a great pleasure to see you again.
Thanks for being here. It's wonderful to be here.
Our question is from Richard of Hancock Park, who attended a concert at the Hollywood Bowl, where it was explained to the audience that Joseph Stalin felt very threatened by the music of Dmitri Shostakovich. Richard says he's heard this before. He understands,
perhaps that someone could be threatened by vocal music, because vocal music carries text. Mm-hmm. But how could someone be threatened by orchestral music? How could it possibly carry political power?
Yes, what a thoughtful question from Richard. And quite truthfully, I've wondered this myself, because for me, music is beautiful, and I couldn't see how somebody could be threatened by it. But you do hear so many governments being threatened by music. So I went to Joanna Demers, who is chair of our musicology department, and we had a really wonderful discussion about that. And it really comes down to about four or five points. You know, first of all, she explained that throughout the 19th and the 20th centuries, well, into the early 20th century, many composers and writers about music speculated that there was power in instrumental music that could convey meaning. It was commonly felt that the actual pitches themselves carried specific meaning that could be picked up by the individual, whether cognitively or consciously or not, but they would feel this. So there was actually meaning that would be embedded into the soul directly from the pitches. Now, we don't think too much that anymore, but that was a very strong, strong belief. So you could see in that regard, it could be extremely threatening if the wrong ideas and the wrong thoughts and feelings were being put in. Second of all is that many people thought, and I think still think, that classical music has a narrative. All of it has a narrative. So you have Symphonie Fantastique, and wow, that's a narrative. And there's so many pieces that have a narrative that immediately you think every classical piece has a narrative. I've had so many people tell me, I don't understand classical music. I can't tell what the story's about. You hear that quite a bit. So if that's a belief that all instrumental music actually has a narrative, then it makes sense that you would be worried about what that narrative is. And that's really alive with us today. Very interesting. I had lunch with Esa-Pekka Salonen, and he was talking about how he's very interested in that. He's interested in finding out what is the narrative that people have going in their heads during a piece when he's conducting or when he's writing. It could be something that's not along party lines, for example. So,
and there was a party when Shostakovich was composing.
One of the party lines, really, during that time was that music in all art had to speak directly to the common man, to the common person. And so they were constantly being afraid of being too complex, of not being able to reach everybody. So that actually directly tied to Shostakovich. He had to worry about that.
He was threatened by the regime because they accused him of not speaking directly to the people or of having this sort of elitist or abstract point of view musically.
That was specific to that regime and what they felt, and it was very, very real. And this is all still alive today. I was in a country not to be named, and I actually go there quite a bit, and I had this conversation with some composers and songwriters as well, and they were totally in line with the idea that they were required, if that's the right word, or strongly encouraged, to write music that made happy thoughts, that gave good thoughts to people, and that they should refrain from doing any kind of pieces that would not make people feel good and feel happy. And that went into not just music, but into filmmaking and everything else. So they're still very, very strong. That sounds alien to us in our country, but it's still alive and well in major countries of the world today.
And in the case of Shostakovich, he suffered terribly from this. His music was banned. Many other composers' music was banned. Mm-hmm. Of course, literary figures were imprisoned and their works banned. So it was much more than just sort of a theoretical debate under Stalin.
Sure, absolutely.
And Richard of Hancock Park, who brought us this great question, might be interested in reading biographies of Shostakovich, because it's believed that some of his music actually contains hidden messages when he was forced to write in a certain way. Musicologists over the years have debated that, but it's a very interesting subject.
Sure, they'll always get around it. The artists will always get around it and always win.
Do you have a question for Dean Robb and his team of experts, or a question about the world of dance, music, or dance? Email your questions to askthedean@kusc.org. Again, that is askthedean@kusc.org. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for Saturday, the 8th of April. I hope you'll join us next week when we head to Pasadena for exhibits about two pioneering women, sci-fi author Octavia E. Butler and Galka Shire, maven of modernism. That's next Saturday at 8 a.m. on Arts Alive. Our technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from contributing reporter Tim Grieving, KUSE's Gail Eichenthal, and Jim Schveda. Thank you also to Sheila Tepper. And I'm Alan Chapman. Brian Lauritsen will be back hosting next week. And have a great weekend.